Erev Tov. All right, welcome to part 16 of the series The Presidents and the Jews, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. So this is actually part one of Franklin Roosevelt. I think it's only fair to give him two lectures, and actually is much more efficient that way because we could divide different aspects of his presidency as he interacted with Jews. It's beyond question that Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, stands out as one of America's greatest presidents. Had he led the nation through one crisis, we would have said Dayenu, but that he led the United States through two crises, the Depression and World War II, puts him in very elite company. And the fact that he served longer than any other person ever did or ever will, absent the repeal of the 22nd Amendment, and that he won an unprecedented four elections, means that he was integrated in people's lives for a good part of their lives. He symbolized the presidency, not just during his own tenure, but for decades after, and symbolized America as well, its grit, its optimism, its capacity to overcome any hardship, and its world leadership. The trouble with FDR arises when you get into the details. What did he do to end the Depression? Were the changes he brought to American society entirely good? Were the changes he brought to the American electorate a positive phenomenon? One can argue quite cogently that the vicious polarization that we see today is a direct result of the political campaigns that Roosevelt ran and show no signs of abating, each group fighting for its own share of the pie. And ultimately, World War II was won, but at what cost? Suffice it to say, there was so much mismanagement, so much unnecessary death, that it would be a scandal, but for the fact that the media were much more discreet back then, the media and the society were much more patriotic, and the war was won definitively, that is, unconditional surrender of the enemy. Now note the change just in this. George Bush is blamed by a subset of the society until today, including apparently by Donald Trump, because of the Arab terror of September 11, 2001. It happened on his watch. So it's become part of the narrative. What did he know? Did he overlook the intelligence? Was he incompetent? Well, was FDR blamed for Pearl Harbor, which happened 8 years into his term? There was also intelligence, advanced intelligence, even real-time intelligence. And in fact, he was blamed by a small and marginalized element of the society for knowing about it in advance and doing nothing in order to get America into World War II. But those critics were minuscule and ignored and construed as outrageous and contemptible cranks and conspiracy theorists. No one took them seriously. No one seriously contemplated that an American president would willfully try to harm the nation. And there are more casualties just in the Battle of the Bulge or in the Battle of Okinawa than in all of America's wars since 2001. And it's not even close. No matter. Society has changed, the media is much more partisan, and the country is more divided. When I was in college, I was a history major, and the focus of my study was actually on FDR. And one of the books we read was a book entitled No Clear and Present Danger. It was written in the early 70s, but nonetheless by revisionists who maintained that America had no reason to be in World War II and Roosevelt forced them in, etc. Well, such sentiments existed even in 1941, but they were perceived as cranks, isolationists, even anti-American. So really, things have changed dramatically, but in such an environment as we live today, it's no surprise that Roosevelt's tenure as president is being scrutinized again and again, and a lot of the myths are being shattered. Certainly when I studied it, there was almost no criticism of his management, only praise, but not anymore. about his governance during the Depression, about his governance during World War II. And for our purposes, the revisionism about FDR takes its most dramatic form when we evaluate FDR and the Jews. In fact, there's a book by that very name, Made It Easy. FDR and the Jews by two history professors, Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman, both in D.C. No president in history has been more idolized by Jews. No president received such consistent and overwhelming support from Jews. And here are the numbers, just from FDR's four elections. Jewish vote, 82%, 85%, and 1940, 1944, 90% of the Jews voted for FDR. And the feelings towards Roosevelt were godlike. People hung his picture on the wall. People mourned his death. And here we come to the Roosevelt conundrum in the guise of the reactions of two families to FDR's death. The first more prevalent, and the second the more recent, even if it only existed. What two families? My wife's family and my family. So Karen said that her father told her that when FDR died, her grandmother sat at the table bawling. All of Bensonhurst wailed and sobbed, a scene straight out of the Megillah. Eivel gadol ha'yehudim, tzom uvchi u'mespeid, sak v'efer yutzel ha'rabim. It was their hero, their savior, father figure was now gone. My family, a little different. Big shock. My father thought FDR was a great president in many ways, but he and my grandfather, Aleinu Shalom, always knew that FDR had done next to nothing to save the Jews. They never forgave him for it. They certainly did not admire him for that. They knew that FDR had used the Jews, and has been reported over the last few decades, many Jews allowed themselves to be used by him. So we had no illusions about Roosevelt, no idol worship. No one was taken in by the jaunty smile and sweet rhetoric. But I have to repeat again, the reaction of Karen's family was the common one, the prevalent one, and not just among the Jews, but among the nation itself. And the historical record is mixed. Roosevelt's accolades have been quick to defend him against any charges of Jew hatred at worst, or even just indifference to the fate of Jews at best. FDR's response to the Holocaust, though, is troubling, to say the least. From a failure to relax immigration laws, a failure to fill existing quotas, something only came to light much later, the rejection of the St. Louis and the return of its passengers to Europe, the refusal to pressure the British to revoke the white paper and allow Jews to flee to the land of Israel, to FDR's conduct of the war, suppressing information about the Holocaust as it was being perpetrated, failure to bomb the crematoria, failure to bomb the rail lines, the infrastructure of death, the machinery of mass murder. All these are counts in the indictment against Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Liberal historians are quick to defend him, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. for one, but there are many others, and part of their defense rests on the perfect vision of hindsight, it's true, and part depends on the reactions of the Jewish establishment of the time, who coddled FDR, who mistook access for influence, and who themselves were in good measure less than keen on saving Jews. So it's a complicated area, it's a controversial area, it will never be settled, and we're not going to settle it tonight, because I want to discuss FDR on the Holocaust next week as a separate topic. But he was such an overpowering personality that he will never be vilified in American history. But as some presidents' reputations improve over time, Truman for one, FDR is a president whose reputation has, will continue to diminish over time, especially by the modern trend of judging past figures by the moral standards of today, even when those standards are not so moral. By his own parameters, Roosevelt was a great president, for he defined great presidents, these are his words, as leaders of thought at a time when certain ideas in the life of the nation had to be clarified. And he was a transformative president. So who was FDR? How did he come to serve the longest presidential term ever? What were his strengths and weaknesses? What were his connections to Jews? Why did Jews fawn over him to the extent that they did? And many still do. I mean, the reflexive Jewish voting pattern for Democrats, that it was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by Joseph Epstein, that traces to FDR. So what was it? Franklin Delano Roosevelt was born January 30th, 1882 in Hyde Park, New York, a wealthy aristocratic family in America already for more than two centuries. Now, there are always rumors that his ancestor, the original to come to America, Klaus von Roosevelt, his six greats, was a Jew, a conversa who fled Holland, but these were rumors spread in Roosevelt's lifetime by Jew haters and by the Nazis, who referred to FDR as Rosenfeld, which is really the same name in German, in their effort to pin the war on the Jews. I'm not so sure what it would mean anyway if Klaus von Roosevelt was a Jew, because 2.5 centuries later, it's clear that Roosevelt and his family were all good Episcopalians. His father, James, was a wealthy businessman who routinely did business with Jews in New York, and his mother, Sarah, from the wealthy Delano family, was late in life awarded the Einstein Medal for Lifetime Humanitarian Service to the Jewish people by a Toronto women's group. Now, it doesn't matter whether or not she deserved the award, but that they gave it to her. That's how she was perceived. And it's true, FDR grew up in a home that was relatively unprejudiced by the standards of the day, including towards Jews. And his parents had social friends who were Jews also, right? Not Haredim. Among their neighbors in Hyde Park for many years were the Morgenthaus. Senior and junior, the son, Henry Morgenthau Jr., became FDR's Treasury Secretary and then became one of the handful of government officials to actually actively help European Jewry during the Holocaust. Roosevelt was an only child whose mother doted on him. He was not a naturally good student. He was educated by private tutors. He traveled extensively with his parents to Europe as a child, including several times to Germany. Roosevelt was fluent in German and in French. At 14, he was sent to private school, Groton, and from there to Harvard, like his father, where he was a solid C student. His studies focused on history and politics, and his worldview was shaped by his parents and his education. And Roosevelt had that streak of noblesse oblige in him. He was put off by the excesses of wealth and privilege. He had a strong humanitarian conscience from an early age, and that's how he saw the world. He saw himself as blessed and therefore obligated to give to society. Certainly Jews were numbered among his classmates in Harvard, yet, consider this, in the 1920s, he was already a public figure, he supported Harvard's quota that limited Jewish enrollment in Harvard, telling Morgenthau that each group should have its share of spots and no group should be overrepresented, a notion of equality that really echoes until today in affirmative action. FDR's father, James, died in 1900, the same year Teddy Roosevelt was elected vice president. Now, their connection was actually tenuous. They were fifth cousins. In fact, Franklin Roosevelt was related to 11 presidents, including Washington and Grant. But the real Roosevelt connection was through his wife, Eleanor. His cousin, I think his second cousin, Eleanor was Teddy Roosevelt's niece, a blood relative, his brother's daughter, and very close to him because Eleanor was orphaned at age 10, and so Teddy raised her. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt gave away the bride when the two married in 1905 while Theodore Roosevelt was president. Theirs was a complicated marriage, to say the least. FDR was tall and handsome, Eleanor less so, and she herself feared that she could never fully satisfy him. And to make matters worse, FDR's mother, Sarah, now widowed, And with FDR, her only child, lived a long life and was a very intrusive and domineering presence in their marriage. She was against the marriage to begin with. She tried several times to break their engagement. Making things worse, the couple moved into the Roosevelt estate in Hyde Park, which was owned by Sarah. Franklin only inherited after she died in 1941. Now, she didn't live there all the time, but she popped in often enough to be a nuisance and to make clear to Eleanor that it was her home and she was living in her home. Well, as is well known, their marriage was uneasy. Within a decade, FDR began a long-term affair with Lucy Mercer. When it was broken up, we'll discuss in a moment, but she married a Rutherford. When he died, they resumed their affair in the 30s, but then other women as well. And their marriage became a mutually beneficial partnership. They had six children, the last of whom died in 1991. But they had a political marriage of a sort that's playing itself out on the national scene today as well. Marriage is described by one writer as connecting pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, each offering something the other lacked. And that's how he saw it, and that's how other political couples see it as well. Roosevelt attended Columbia Law School, but didn't graduate. Instead, in his 30s, he just tried passing the bar. He passed the bar on his own initiative after a few times. He joined a law practice, didn't care for it, was elected state senator, and from that position, embraced progressive politics, supported Wilson in 1912, and was rewarded with an appointment as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, with everyone obviously aware that that had been Teddy Roosevelt's entry into national politics as well. Franklin and Teddy did not really get along, and not only because they were in different political parties. When World War I started, Teddy Roosevelt encouraged Franklin to resign his post and go fight. Exactly what Teddy did. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy when the Spanish-American War broke out 19 years earlier. FDR did not, and so Teddy thought him to be an irredeemable coward. Not long after, Eleanor became aware of Franklin's affair, threatened divorce, and Sarah and Roosevelt's close aide, Lewis Howe, both intervened and saved the marriage and probably Franklin's political career. In New York and then in Washington, FDR became allies with many Jews and familiar with Jewish life and interests. He had nothing to do with this, but in 1915, while he was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, the U.S. Navy dispatched a vessel carrying 900 tons of food, including matzah, to Jews in Israel who were literally starving because of the war. Remember, the Turks were on the other side. This was the initiative of FDR's boss, the Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels. But FDR, then in Washington, met Jews who had influenced him his whole life. One was Brandeis, and FDR became friendly as well with a young Felix Frankfurter. Now, Frankfurter was born in Vienna. He grew up in a frum home, a religious home. He was observant himself, but he abandoned everything when he attended City College. At the time, he was a brilliant, not to blame City College, blame Frankfurter. He was a brilliant Harvard law professor, and he was sent on assignment to the War Labor Policies Board in Washington during the war. Knew from growing up in a firm family, Frankfurter was intermarried. Not only intermarried, but intermarried to the daughter of a Protestant minister, no less. Completely uninvolved in Jewish life, until Brandeis made him a Zionist, and Frankfurter even served as a Zionist delegate to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. From his earliest days in politics, Roosevelt surrounded himself with Jewish advisors, dozens in fact, and the Jews were aware of this. Just to fast forward, in 1939, Roosevelt nominated Frankfurter to the U.S. Supreme Court, replacing the retired Cardozo. And again, just like with Brandeis, there were numerous objections, and Felix Frankfurter became the very first judicial nominee ever to appear in person before the Senate Judiciary Committee, a now routine spectacle, emphasis on the spectacle. And he was approved, and he was a reliable liberal justice until his death in 1962. It's interesting in retrospect, but FDR was much more open to Jews at first than was Eleanor. For example, she had a much more sheltered upbringing. She didn't like Frankfurter calling him. All these things come out years later. An interesting little man, but very Jew. And she had similar snide comments about other Jews, but that was more in keeping with the social prejudices of the time than any deep-seated animus. In truth, FDR had little role in World War I and the Balfour Declaration, but he won the nomination for the vice presidency of the Democrats in 1920, if for no other reason than his last name. He had a very attractive personality, and for ticket balance, James Cox from Ohio, and they chose a New Yorker. The Republicans swept to power, Harding, we discussed last week, but FDR performed well as a candidate, and it made him a national figure. And then came really the defining moment, the defining tragedy in Roosevelt's life. He lost the election in 1920 in November. In August 1921, he contracted polio. Polio was a rampant and ravaging disease. He was at first misdiagnosed, and his condition was exacerbated until a specialist, after 3 weeks, diagnosed his malady. At the time, polio victims, for the most part, could never walk again. Within a short time, FDR aged very rapidly, but bedridden, he spent his time studying the illness, and he was determined to walk again. He was only in his 30s at the time. He found that the hot waters of Warm Springs, Georgia, helped him with mobility, and within a few years, he bought the facility. In truth, he never walked again unaided, but he strengthened himself enough through sheer willpower that he was able to swing his legs with crutches, using his now powerful forearms to guide his body forward. So the average viewer would not know that he couldn't walk, but that he walked with crutches. When he spoke, he was supported by heavy braces on his legs, and he clung with both hands to the podium to hold himself up, such he never moved his hands when he spoke, that I'm doing now. But he compensated as well. He became an excellent orator, and he made up for the lack of hand movements by using his head in a similar way, moving his head for emphasis side to side as he spoke. And if you see clips of FDR speaking while standing, that's why he's doing what he's doing. His hands are clutching the podium. In private, he always used a wheelchair. And even in the White House, he moved around in a wheelchair with the understanding that he would never be photographed in it. And the journalists of the day complied, something unthinkable today. In fact, I think there are two pictures of Roosevelt in a wheelchair. You can see them in Hyde Park. He designed his own wheelchair, no armrest, just wheels, so it could easily fit under a desk. And that wheelchair also you could see at his home in Hyde Park, always worth a visit. It's undeniable that overcoming polio, and it took years, not only endeared him to the public, but changed him in a way, made him even more empathetic to others, made him even more sympathetic to the voters. Today we would say in our psychobabble that it grounded him, it made him a better person, and made him even more determined to help the underdog. With this caveat, he would help the underdog who would vote for him. Where the votes were there, those the underdogs he tried to help, that it didn't always happen, and that he possessed blind spots that would always color his attitudes, so that just makes him human. Roosevelt held no office for most of the 1920s, an era of Republican dominance, marked by peace and prosperity, but also by restrictive immigration laws that would seed the ground for a Democrat revival. So Roosevelt returned to the public view in 1924 by nominating New York Governor Al Smith for president. Now, Smith did not get the nomination that year, but after being out of the public eye for almost 3 years and walking slowly with his crutches onto the stage at Madison Square Garden to thunderous applause, think Willis Reed, 7th game, May 1970, except that Smith didn't win. So you see the effect it had on people. Roosevelt spoke for 45 minutes, and to the public, he was back. In 1928, he again nominated Smith for president at the convention in Houston, even asking for And finding a rabbi in Houston wasn't easy to deliver one of the invocations. He thought it good politics have a rabbi, priest, and minister all give invocations. Smith lost. The first Catholic to run for president. Smith was also against prohibition, which many people were, but few would say publicly, and it cost him some southern states. But in any event, Hoover would have trounced whoever the Democrat candidate was. Meanwhile, Roosevelt was persuaded, 1928, by the party bosses to run for governor of New York. He was reluctant, but it was explained to him that the Republicans were running Albert Ottinger, a Jewish lawyer, New York State Senator, and the natural Democrat candidate to run against him, Herbert Lehman, was also a Jew. You can't have two Jews running against each other. Who said this? The Jews. The Jewish leaders feared Jew hatred if the two candidates would be Jews. And besides, the party leader said, if Lehman ran, that would mean the top of the ticket of the Democrats in New York in that election year would be Smith, a Catholic, and Lehman, a Jew, and that would be a disaster as far as the Democrats were concerned. Conversely, the accusation was raised that the Republicans had nominated Ottinger for governor only because of the sorry record of the Republican Party on immigration and were looking to curry favor with the Jews, Ottinger as fig leaf. So FDR agreed, Lehman ran as his lieutenant governor, and Roosevelt squeaked to victory, barely beating Ottinger by 1% of the vote, 25,000 votes out of 4 million cast. Imagine, a change of just a few thousand votes would have effectively ended Roosevelt's political career, or at least derailed it. And FDR had to walk a tightrope not to alienate New York Jews and simultaneously try to win the Jewish vote as much as he could away from Ottinger. Names should ring a bell to political junkies. His nephew, Dick Richard Ottinger, was a Democrat congressman for about 20 years, 60s to the 80s. He ran for Senate and lost in 1970. Well, one way FDR smoothed the process was by attracting more Jewish advisors to his cause. Many of these people would remain with FDR for the next 17 years in one capacity or another. First, he recruited Samuel Rosenman to be his primary speechwriter. Rosenman was a former New York State Assemblyman, Texas-born, Columbia law grad, actually became the first White House counsel in 1943, but he was an advisor for Roosevelt from now till the end of Roosevelt's life. Another figure would play a role in this election, whom FDR had known now for almost 20 years, but made his first appearance for Roosevelt, remains today one of the most controversial Jews of this period, Reform Rabbi Stephen Wise. He was a Jew who was closest to FDR, and the Jew had the ability, if anyone did, of influencing him on Holocaust matters that he largely failed, preferring, again, access to influence and the illusion of friendship to actual accomplishment is an issue for next week. I mean, there were private dinners that Wise had with Roosevelt in the White House during the war, which he did not even raise the Holocaust that was ongoing. Wise was born in Budapest in 1874, came to the U.S. as an infant. His grandfather, Yosef, was chief rabbi in a small town in Hungary, Charedi. They started climbing down the ladder. His father was already the rabbi of a conservative congregation in New York, and he stepped even further, studying in Europe for ordination as a Reform rabbi. He was a progressive with a capital P. A liberal with a capital L, or an L in bold. He was involved in founding the NAACP, involved in founding the ACLU. He was a very strong personality outside of his dealings with FDR. While serving in his first pulpit in Oregon, for example, he was offered the position in Temple Emmanuel in Manhattan. He turned it down when he learned that he would have to submit his sermons for advance approval to the board. They tried that here once also, by the way. So he saw that rightly as an attack on the freedom of the pulpit. He spurned their offer and he found his own temple called the Free Synagogue. Now it's named after him, the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue, founded in 1907. New, what's the pshat in free? One of the original members was Henry Morgenthau Sr., later became FDR's neighbor in Hyde Park. Morgenthau said, free means pewless and dueless. I would add clueless to that also, because someone has to pay something. Wise also started his own rabbinical school, the Jewish Institute of Religion, HJIR, which soon merged with HUC, the Hebrew College. That's why they still have six initials. Wise was an early supporter of Zionism, and that too separated him from the Reform movement. It was Wise who made a major FDR campaign speech in 1928 urging Jews to ignore what he called the irrelevant appeal to Ottinger's Jewishness and vote as patriots for Roosevelt. Who knows how many votes he swayed, but again, the margin of victory was so small. FDR won, as did Herbert Lehman. So Lehman became the governor in 1933 when FDR was elected president, and he served until 1943 when Roosevelt appointed him to head some UN relief effort. All three of Lehman's sons fought in World War II. One was killed in action. Lehman became an outstanding pro-Israel senator in 1950, but he was involved also in the establishment of the State of Israel. Of course, Lehman College is named after him, and something else as well. Good trivia. He's one of the few Americans to have a yeshuv in Israel named after him. Lehman is a small yeshuv north of Achziv, south of Rosh HaNikra, on the Mediterranean coast, called Lehman, Lamed Yud Mem Nun, after Herbert Lehman. Interestingly, given subsequent events, Wise had a falling out with Roosevelt as governor, didn't think he was progressive enough, and so did not support him for president. But after Roosevelt was elected, Wise wrote him a very conciliatory letter, and he was back in the fold. And as governor, Roosevelt continued to rely on Jewish advisors, Rosamond and Frankfurter. Joe Proskauer, who was the head of one of the AJCs, a big judge and law firm. Proskauer, still law firm today. And Jews generally turned even more against the Republicans when Hoover declined to protest or take any action in response to the massacres in 1929 in Hebron or elsewhere. It was government policy going back to Buchanan's time, breached only a couple of times, one by Teddy Roosevelt in Kishinev. It's not their business to criticize how other nations treat their Jews. All right, go figure. Then came the crash and the Depression. And Roosevelt was at the epicenter of the crash in New York. Jews especially suffered during the Depression because there was still discrimination in jobs and education. Shabbos was not protected. Not that that mattered to every Jew, but it did to many Jews. And Jews had, especially New York Jews, had invested in great numbers and great amounts of money in the augustly named and Jewish-owned and mismanaged Bank of United States, one of the first banks to fail. And there was no FDIC, that was an FDR initiative. So their money was lost. None of the big banks wanted to take responsibility. I'll say it a different way. All the big banks refused to take responsibility to merge with a bank whose depositors were mainly Jewish immigrant workers. FDR was sympathetic to his constituents, but he did nothing to help them. Now, Jews in New York also became aware already in 1930 of the growing influence of the Nazi Party in Germany, emboldened by the economic collapse there. The Nazis became the second largest party in the Reichstag already in 1930. 3 years later, they were the largest party. As aware as they were, American Jews suffered during the Depression like anyone else. In the early 30s, they did little about the Nazis. That would come later to some extent. But Jews suffered the unemployment, the homelessness, the poverty, the great gevirim who had underwritten the growth of Jewish institutions from 1910 on lost their wealth. They still had money, but their wealth they lacked. By 1930, Roosevelt's name was being mentioned as a contender for the presidency, only for lack of other options, and he encouraged it, winning election, re-election as governor, 1930, then New York governor served 2 years, and then cultivating a team that would win him the nomination, including Morgenthau Sr., including Bernard Baruch, and others as well. 1932, Roosevelt won nomination on the fourth ballot. For both practical and political reasons, Roosevelt was urged to stay home, run a front porch campaign, lie low, just take advantage of Hoover's unpopularity. He refused. He traveled, spoke more than 100 times during the campaign, making promises for bold action that would be taken during his first 100 days in office, all of which prepped the people for the major changes to American life that Roosevelt would lead. And he won a smashing victory. A victory for him, as well as a repudiation of Hoover. And FDR believed very simply, his strength was that he embodied action. People wanted something done. And even if it didn't necessarily work, something was happening. And it almost didn't happen. History is filled with ironies. February 15th, 1933, just weeks before FDR was inaugurated, he spoke in Miami Beach, after which a deranged, unemployed bricklayer, Giuseppe Zangara, fired shots at FDR, missing him, but killing Chicago's mayor, Anton Cermak, who was standing right next to him. Rather than blame lax gun control laws, Zangara was arrested, tried, convicted, and electrocuted a little over a month later, March 20th. His last words, "Go ahead, push the button," which is appropriate. By then, FDR had been sworn in as the nation's 32nd president. Roosevelt took office, promising a new deal for the American people, radiating optimism, telling the nation that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And he was a whirlwind of activity. And within a few years, he redefined the presidency and the role of government in American life. And the great shift was the involvement of government as employer, a major employer, and government as caretaker of the American people. So the focus of government changed, hasn't changed back yet, from one that facilitated personal autonomy and encouraged self-help or charity, to one that constricted personal autonomy in order to achieve some desired social goals. Jacob Schiff had said in the 1910s, a Jew would rather cut his hand off than apply for relief from non-Jewish sources. Well, that too would change. And the government that Roosevelt headed immediately had to deal with starvation, with homelessness, with dysfunction. People ran out of money, literally ran out of money. An active barter system was set up in hundreds of places. People traded haircuts for apples. Roosevelt was determined to put people back to work, and he created a host of government agencies to do it, to oversee it, and sustain it. And it would later give rise to Ronald Reagan's quip, "No government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size. Government programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth." And when Roosevelt said it, he meant the New Deal. Harold Ickes, who was FDR's confidant and Secretary of the Interior, called the New Deal a bloodless revolution, which it was. People were desperate. People wanted action. And most people were not much concerned about constitutional niceties. Again, Reagan, "As government expands, liberty contracts." And remember that Reagan then was a Democrat, and he voted for Roosevelt. Years later, he sensed the New Deal had gone too far. Well, how far did it go? Within 100 days, a Congress with a large Democrat majority had overwhelmingly passed numerous bills altering American life and trying to reverse the effects of the Great Depression. The first thing he did was declare a bank holiday. Banks closed, no withdrawals allowed, and soon after the FDIC was created, and the federal government thereafter guaranteed the security of investments, which protected the average investor. It's a vicious cycle. Banks are in danger of failing. People withdraw their money if possible. Banks then have less to invest. Businesses suffer. Businesses fail. Jobs lost. Banks fail. with a guarantee the money will always be there. Of course, with a guarantee, it lends itself to speculation, speculative investment on the part of bankers as well. The SEC was created in 1934 to regulate Wall Street. Joseph Kennedy, Jack Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, became the first chairman. National Industrial Recovery Act began to regulate business, prices, non-competition. 1938, a minimum wage, production restrictions, all of which was a limitation on free enterprise that was said to be required in this crisis. And more importantly, Roosevelt spent the government into a huge deficit, implementing what became known as Keynesian economics, that if government pumps money into the economy, even artificially, people have more to spend, they'll spend it, and commerce itself will grow and the economy will recover. This theory of the British economist who was alive then, John Maynard Keynes, has dominated American life for almost 80 years and remains a central plank of the Democrat Party. It was the antithesis of the Reagan recovery, and it was the inspiration behind the Obama billion-dollar stimulus. It's a great theory. Keynes held that for every dollar in public spending, it generates $4 of national income. Regardless of its veracity, that remains Democrat gospel until today. And it works in the short term, but never in the long term, because in the long term, the government runs out of money or so inflates the currency that the money is worth less. But as Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. So who cares about the long term? And the Keynes was devastated by Milton Friedman, who said once, back in two sentences, destroys a theory, if you want full employment, the government should pay half the people to dig holes and pay the other half the people to fill the holes. Then you have full employment. But eventually the bubble bursts because you have to create something of value or everything becomes valueless. But FDR bought into it, created a host of public works projects to put millions to work, many of which we still benefit from today. Roads, bridges, tunnels, dams, power stations. The entrance to the FDR Drive, entrance to the Triborough Bridge, still has a sign built by Works Progress Administration. It was the East River Drive, and of course named for FDR. The Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC, gave jobs to young unemployed. And this WPA, the Works Progress Administration, did the infrastructure building as well as employed artists and writers and musicians, etc. The public payroll increased dramatically and public sector employees became a huge Democrat constituency until today. Hoover also done that, but not as broadly. And he created the NRA, the National Recovery Administration, designed to enable industry, labor, and government to work together. The AAA paid farmers not to plant so as to reduce surpluses and maintain prices. And this was kept secret. For example, word got out in 1935 that the government had killed and disposed of 6 million pigs, and people were outraged. That's a lot of bacon that could have fed starving people, but prices had to be maintained. What an economist understands, the average person won't. You know, wheat, corn, meat, destroyed just to maintain price levels. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935, the Wagner Act, named after New York Senator Robert Wagner, his son later became the mayor of New York City, guaranteed the right of workers to unionize and to strike and to collectively bargain for wages and benefits. The Social Security Act guaranteed pensions to senior citizens. So this was the brainchild of Frances Perkins, as the first woman to serve in the cabinet as Secretary of Labor, and she could not sell it to FDR at first. He simply said to her, it sounds like a Ponzi scheme. Right? He used that word. Ponzi had done his deeds in the early 20s, but you take money from one group to give to an individual. He said, Roosevelt asked, what happens when there are more recipients than workers? Or the recipients receive more money than the workers are putting in? So Roosevelt was told the earliest that could happen was 1980. And he said, he balked. And he said, we can't do it because we're responsible for the future as well. But then he relented. And that's where we are today. In the beginning, I think, the the taxes of 16 workers paid for one retiree. Now it's a little less than two workers per retiree, and within a decade it'll be one worker per retiree. Just assign a person to a retiree and they can make their own deal on the side. Not to mention that the Social Security contributions were originally set aside to use only in the program. It was LBJ who opened those funds to the general budget that don't really exist anymore today, and that's where we are. But the political benefit was huge, and this was another FDR revolution. The economy improved, but not dramatically, by the time the election of 1936 came. Unemployment was falling because government employment was very, very high, but it would ricochet and increase again during Roosevelt's second term. What he did successfully, though, in 1936... and this affects us also, was create a series of coalitions, or create one coalition with a series of groups. And the Democrat Party since then has ridden this horse to whatever success they've had, and to a degree, the Republicans have been forced to do the same. It was the beginning, 1936, of interest group politics. Your vote was not sought because of who you were, but because of what the government could do for your group. So who were the Democrat groups? Those who got the largest share of government spoils and wanted the spigot never to close. Union workers, farmers, the poor, senior citizens, and of course the Jews. Blacks were not yet a Democrat constituency because the Southern Democrats were racist. That would change in the mid-1960s. So to help digest these changes, we've been there ever since. You know from the group based on how they're going to vote. And that's why there's targeted mailing and polling and campaigning, etc. No politician goes outside his group. It's a waste of time. To help digest these changes, or to distract people from their woes, or because it wasn't working, prohibition was repealed in 1933, soon after Roosevelt took office. Now, prohibition had been a benefit to Jews, at least to some Jews, as sacramental wine was excluded from prohibition. So some shuls, some rabbis, and other Jews who made a nice living selling so-called excess sacramental wine. Now, there were Jewish bootleggers also. So what was the shtick? The law exempted sacramental wine, and rabbis could order wine based on the number of members they had. Shul membership rosters exploded. Many members, oddly, had Irish names. Nonetheless, at one point, Ramosha Zvulun Margulies, Ramaz, even lobbied the government that he should be given the monopoly on sacramental wine distribution in New York to prevent fraud. Not to mention, it would have been quite lucrative as well, but it didn't work. Roosevelt showered the people with federal money, such that for the first time in history, in the election year of 1936, federal spending exceeded the spending of all the states combined. I don't think it's ever been reversed. And Roosevelt won the biggest landslide ever, defeating Alfred Landon, 61% to 38%, 523 electoral votes to 8 for Landon. Landon won only 2 states. You know, there was an old political maxim, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. Maine was then the Ohio, Florida of today, a swing state, a bellwether state. Well, Roosevelt lost 2 states, Maine and Vermont, and his campaign manager said, as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. And they didn't really care much about them. Jews were deeply involved in FDR's brain trust, his corps of advisors. Some 15% of FDR's federal appointments were Jews. Think about it, just our percentage of the population. And the appointments alone endeared him to the Jewish people. Jews played an outsized role in his administration and in the New Deal, which was Gan Eden for progressives. Rosamond and Frankfurter, Brandeis, notwithstanding the Supreme Court justice, helped write legislation for the New Deal. Roosevelt called him Old Isaiah. Morgenthau, Benjamin Cohen, David Lilienthal, later in the 40s, David Niles. One after another, you had Jews. Not all of them, for most of them were not religious or that committed, but most of them at least had a pride in their ethnic identity, They surrounded Roosevelt, which only makes their conduct during the Holocaust that much more difficult to accept. All right, there was pushback against the New Deal. If the government controls of the economy remind one of socialism, it should. That was a typical attack against FDR, and not without reason. Consider, socialism was all the rage back then. Just a few years early, the late 1920s, the writer, the progressive Lincoln Steffens, had returned from the Soviet Union and proclaimed, "I've been over to the future, and it works." Walter Duranty, Times correspondent, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1933, extolling Stalin's economic program, notwithstanding that it didn't work. The Soviets had a gift in being able to dupe gullible American leftists. During FDR's first term, Stalin starved millions of Ukrainians, maybe 3, 4, 5 million Ukrainians to death. So they took their grain and sent it eastward to Russia, but the news was suppressed. While Duranty was winning his Pulitzer Prize with articles about the great Soviet experiment, people were being murdered by the millions, starved to death. So people didn't know that it didn't work. Americans were against socialism without truly knowing why. And we've seen, you could do almost anything that socialists do if you call it a different name and it benefits a group, that group will like it. How successful the New Deal was in ending the Depression is debated until today. The Dow Jones average did not return to pre-crash levels until the Eisenhower administration. Unemployment was 17.4% in September 1931. In January 1938, it was 17.4%. Now, it exceeded 25% in the interim, and even gone down as low as 13. But as is clear to modern scholars, read The Forgotten Man by Amity Schles, it wasn't FDR who ended the Depression, it was World War II. Admittedly, that point remains controversial, and FDR's defenders continue to salute him, but that's politics and not always history. The great rebuke to the New Deal came in one of the most famous Supreme Court cases of the era, Schachter-Poultry versus the United States. We studied this case in law school. The Schachters were brothers in Brooklyn from Jews who operated a couple slaughterhouses and kosher butcher shops. And the government went looking for an easy target to prosecute. They were prosecuted for violating provisions of the NIRA rules involving work hours for employees, minimum wages, selling unfit chickens. It was called to the public the sick chicken case. And even violating a rule shows you how technical the government got that prohibited a customer from choosing the particular chicken from the coop that he or she wanted slaughtered. In other words, the minhag was you went to the slaughterhouse and the chicken in the coop and you looked at the chicken that you wanted and you grabbed it. Or you told the shaykhet or the manager, "I want that chicken in the back." All right? The government passed a rule called the straight killing rule. The first chicken you touch, that's your chicken. They violated that. Now, if you ask what difference does it make whether you take the first chicken or the fifth chicken, you should know that you could ask the same thing about a million other government regulations that also make no sense. Areas of commerce in which government, especially the federal government, should not be involved. Now, bear in mind, as a religious business, they had a closed Friday afternoon, they closed Shabbos. During busy seasons, the output and hours of the Shochtim had to increase. And they knew they couldn't sell unhealthy chickens as a matter of halacha. That's why they wanted the customer to choose the chicken. And they claimed that government inspectors were heavy-handed, rude to the Jewish customers, profane, had cost them business, and they took particular offense at the allegation they sold two sick chickens, because to them it questioned their frumkeit. And of course, their prices had to be based on the kosher market and could not be set by the government, which was also unrealistic for the kosher business and its needs. Well, the Schachter brothers, the four of them, were tried in the Eastern District. Four brothers, thick accents, broken English, represented by Joseph Heller, Brooklyn Law School, against the U.S. Attorney and other New Deal WASP establishment lawyers. The four brothers were convicted. sentenced to a fine of more than $7,000, which was several years' worth of salary, and a few months in jail for each brother. 3-2-1-1. They appealed. Now, I'll tell you an interesting thing. I knew one of the plaintiffs in the case, the youngest Schechter brother. I think his name was Aaron Schechter. His granddaughter was a classmate of mine in law school. And he, Aaron Schechter, lived in the building where we had our law offices. I once asked him about the case. Now you're talking 50 years later, even more. I asked him about the case, and he saw the same thick accent. He didn't really understand what had happened. It seems the Schechters were just pawns that were used by both sides in the New Deal drama, because there was tremendous antipathy to all this legislation. All he knew was that the government was trying to ruin his business. So he was a very nice fellow. There were also other NRA convictions across the country. They lost. They lost on appeal. They appealed to the Supreme Court. May 1935, the Supreme Court unanimously overturned the convictions and ruled the bulk of the NRA unconstitutional as it asserted legislative powers that the executive branch simply did not have. Chief Justice Hughes said the NRA abused the Schechters. FDR was enraged because his life's work was now under siege. Brandeis sent word directly to an aide to FDR. Came to hear the decision read. It was in the robing room. Go back and tell the president that the court is not going to let the government centralize everything. It was a legal earthquake. And this and other reversals set in motion FDR's notorious scheme to pack the Supreme Court, to add friendly justices up to 15. The Constitution is actually silent on how many justices there must be in the Supreme Court. 9 is a minute, but doesn't say it anywhere. Congress rebuffed FDR, refused to expand the Supreme Court, but under obvious and subtle pressure. And it's as true for Roberts and Obamacare as it is in this case. The court does read the election returns. The court upheld a year later the Wagner Act, or 2 years later, the Wagner Act, 5-4. Both Brandeis and Cardozo, the majority, and then justices began retiring or dying. Within a few years, Roosevelt had appointed 7 of the sitting justices, one of them being Frankfurter, again nominated, notwithstanding that the Jewish leaders pleaded with Roosevelt not to appoint him for fear of provoking Jew hatred, and the court crisis abated. And the Schechters went back to business. Mrs. Schechter wrote a poem, who was the lead defendant, Joseph Schechter's wife, about the ordeal and the embarrassment. And you know, Jews can be hard on each other as well. She had to endure for several years the sarcastic cracks of neighbors. After her husband was convicted, she wrote a poem, published in a local newspaper. The poem ended, "I'm through with that experience. I hope for all my life and proud again to be Joseph Schechter's wife." Now, FDR also changed the presidency in another way. One reason why he always remained popular and was able to win 4 elections. He was always positive, was always doing something, and also kept in touch with the people as no president had done before. The fireside chat, nighttime radio broadcast direct from the White House made people feel the president was speaking to them, cared about them, and was serving the people. It lapsed after his presidency, but Reagan would institute reinstitute policy. Continues until today, the weekly radio broadcast Shabbos morning. But FDR saw the task of the presidency primarily as moral leadership. And in this sphere, he provided it, if not completely successfully. But it would be the FDR who dealt with the real Jewish problems, immigration, persecution, and the Holocaust, that his moral leadership would really be tested, and that would shape Jewish attitudes towards him in a way that is still not resolved today. That story, next week. I thank you all very much.